Moscow. And my people. Have they reached Moscow at last? He asked seriously. Yes, they have. Julie Drubetskaya told me so. I went to see them, but missed them. They have gone to your estate near Moscow. Chapter 25. Prince Andrei's opinions on war. The spirit of the army. The officers were about to take leave, but Prince Andrei, apparently reluctant to be left alone with his friend, asked them to stay and have tea. Seats were brought in, and so was the tea. The officers gazed with surprise at Pierre's huge, stout figure and listened to his talk of Moscow and the position of our army round which he had ridden. Prince Andrei remained silent, and his expression was so forbidding that Pierre addressed his remarks chiefly to the good-natured battalion commander. So, you understand the whole position of our troops? Prince Andrei interrupted him. Yes, that is, how do you mean? Said Pierre. Not being a military man, I can't say I have understood it fully, but I understand the general position. Well then, you know more than anyone else, be it who it may, said Prince Andrei. Oh, said Pierre, looking over his spectacles in perplexity at Prince Andrei. Well, and what do you think of Kutuzov's appointment? He asked. I was very glad of his appointment. That's all I know, replied Prince Andrei. And tell me your opinion of Barclay de Tolly. In Moscow they're saying heaven knows what about him. What do you think of him? Ask them, replied Prince Andrei, indicating the officers. Pierre looked at Timokhin with the condescendingly interrogative smile with which everybody involuntarily addressed that officer. "'We see light again, since His Serenity has been appointed, Your Excellency,' said Timokhin timidly, and continually turning to glance at his colonel. "'Why so?' asked Pierre. "'Well, to mention only firewood and fodder, let me inform you. Why, when we were retreating from Svensiani, we dared not touch a stick or a wisp of hay or anything. You see, we were going away, so he would get it all. Wasn't it so, Your Excellency?' And again Timokhin turned to the prince. But we daren't. In our regiment, two officers were court-martialed for that kind of thing. But when His Serenity took command, everything became straightforward. Now we see light. Then why was it forbidden? Timokhin looked about in confusion, not knowing what or how to answer such a question. Pierre put the same question to Prince Andrei. Why? So as not to lay waste the country we were abandoning to the enemy, said Prince Andrei with venomous irony. It is very sound. One can't permit the land to be pillaged and accustom the troops to marauding. At Smolensk, too, he judged correctly that the French might outflank us as they had larger forces. But he could not understand this, cried Prince Andrei in a shrill voice that seemed to escape him involuntarily. He could not understand that there, for the first time, we were fighting for Russian soil, and that there was a spirit in the men such as I had never seen before, that we had held the French for 2 days, and that that success had increased our strength tenfold. He ordered us to retreat, and all our efforts and losses went for nothing. He had no thought of betraying us. He tried to do the best he could. He thought out everything, and that is why he is unsuitable. He is unsuitable now just because he plans out everything very thoroughly and accurately, as every German has to. How can I explain? Well, say your father has a German valet, and he is a splendid valet and satisfies your father's requirements better than you could. Then it's all right to let him serve. But if your father is mortally sick, you'll send the valet away and attend to your father with your own unpracticed, awkward hands, and will soothe him better than a skilled man who is a stranger could. So it has been with Barclay. While Russia was well, a foreigner could serve her and be a splendid minister. But as soon as she is in danger, she needs one of her own kin. But in your club, they've been making him out a traitor. They slander him as a traitor. And the only result will be that afterwards, ashamed of their false accusations, they will make him out a hero or a genius instead of a traitor, and that will be still more unjust. He is an honest and very punctilious German.
"And they say he's a skilful commander," rejoined Pierre.
"I don't understand what is meant by a skilful commander," replied Prince Andrei ironically.
"A skilful commander?" replied Pierre. "Why, one who foresees all contingencies and foresees the adversary's intentions."
"But that's impossible," said Prince Andrei, as if it were a matter settled long ago.
Pierre looked at him in surprise. "And yet they say that war is like a game of chess," he remarked.
"Yes," replied Prince Andrei, "but with this little difference, that in chess you may think over each move as long as you please, and are not limited for time, and with this difference, too, that a knight is always stronger than a pawn, and two pawns are always stronger than one, while in war a battalion is sometimes stronger than a division, and sometimes weaker than a company. The relative strength of bodies of troops can never be known to anyone. Believe me," he went on, "if things depended on arrangements made by the staff, I should be there making arrangements, but instead of that, I have the honour to serve here in the regiment with these gentlemen, and I consider that on us tomorrow's battle will depend, and not on those others. Success never depends and never will depend on position or equipment or even on numbers, and least of all on position."
"But on what, then?"
"On the feeling that is in me and is in him," he pointed to Timokhin, "and in each soldier."
Prince Andrei glanced at Timokhin, who looked at his commander in alarm and bewilderment. In contrast to his former reticent taciturnity, Prince Andrei now seemed excited. He could apparently not refrain from expressing the thoughts that had suddenly occurred to him.
"A battle is won by those who firmly resolve to win it. Why did we lose the battle at Austerlitz? The French losses were almost equal to ours, but very early we said to ourselves that we were losing the battle, and we did lose it. And we said so because we had nothing to fight for there. We wanted to get away from the battlefield as soon as we could. We've lost, so let us run, and we ran. If we had not said that till the evening, heaven knows what might not have happened. But tomorrow we shan't say it. You talk about our position, the left flank weak and the right flank too extended," he went on. "That's all nonsense. There's nothing of the kind. But what awaits us tomorrow? 100 million most diverse chances, which will be decided on the instant by the fact that our men or theirs run or do not run, and that this man or that man is killed. But all that is being done at present is only play. The fact is that those men with whom you have ridden round the position not only do not help matters, but hinder. They are only concerned with their own petty interests."
"At such a moment?" said Pierre reproachfully.
"At such a moment," Prince Andrei repeated. "To them it is only a moment affording opportunities to undermine a rival and obtain an extra cross or ribbon. For me, tomorrow means this. A Russian army of 100,000 and a French army of 100,000 have met to fight, and the thing is that these 200,000 men will fight, and the side that fights more fiercely and spares itself least will win. And if you like, I will tell you that whatever happens and whatever muddles those at the top may make, we shall win tomorrow's battle. Tomorrow, happen what may, we shall win."
"There now, Your Excellency, that's the truth, the real truth," said Timokhin. "Who would spare himself now? The soldiers in my battalion, believe me, wouldn't drink their vodka. It's not the day for that, they say."
All were silent. The officers rose. Prince Andrei went out of the shed with them, giving final orders to the adjutant. After they had gone, Pierre approached Prince Andrei and was about to start a conversation when they heard the clatter of three horses' hooves on the road not far from the shed, and looking in that direction, Prince Andrei recognised Voltsogen and Clausewitz, accompanied by a Cossack. They rode close by, continuing to converse, and Prince Andrei involuntarily heard these words:
"Der Krieg muss in Raum verlegt werden. Der Ansicht kann ich nicht genug preisgeben," said one of them.
"The war must be extended widely. I cannot sufficiently commend that view."
"Oh, ja," said the other. "Der Zweck ist nur, den Feind zu schwächen. So kann man gewiss nicht der Verlust der Privatperson in Achtung nehmen."
Oh, yes. The only aim is to weaken the enemy, so of course one cannot take into account the loss of private individuals.
Oh, no, agreed the other.
Extend widely, said Prince Andrei with an angry snort when they had ridden past. In that extend were my father, son, and sister at Bald Hills. That's all the same to him.
That's what I was saying to you. Those German gentlemen won't win the battle tomorrow, but will only make all the mess they can, because they have nothing in their German heads but theories not worth an empty eggshell, and haven't in their hearts the one thing needed tomorrow, that which Timochin has. They have yielded up all Europe to him, and have now come to teach us, fine teachers. And again his voice grew shrill.
So, you think we shall win tomorrow's battle? Asked Pierre.
Yes, yes, answered Prince Andrei absently. One thing I would do if I had the power, he began again. I would not take prisoners.
Why take prisoners? It's chivalry. The French have destroyed my home and are on their way to destroy Moscow. They have outraged and are outraging me every moment. They are my enemies. In my opinion, they are all criminals, and so thinks Timochin and the whole army. They should be executed. Since they are my foes, they cannot be my friends, whatever may have been said at Tilsit.
Yes, yes, muttered Pierre, looking with shining eyes at Prince Andrei. I quite agree with you. The question that had perturbed Pierre on the Mozhaisk Hill and all that day now seemed to him quite clear and completely solved. He now understood the whole meaning and importance of this war and of the impending battle. All he had seen that day, all the significant and stern expressions on the faces he had seen in passing, were lit up for him by a new light. He understood that latent heat, as they say in physics, of patriotism which was present in all these men he had seen, and this explained to him why they all prepared for death calmly and, as it were, light-heartedly.
Not take prisoners, Prince Andrei continued. That by itself would quite change the whole war and make it less cruel. As it is, we have played at war. That's what is vile. We play at magnanimity and all that stuff. Such magnanimity and sensibility are like the magnanimity and sensibility of a lady who faints when she sees a calf being killed. She is so kind-hearted that she can't look at blood, but enjoys eating the calf served up with sauce. They talk to us of the rules of war, of chivalry, of flags of truce, of mercy to the unfortunate, and so on. It's all rubbish! I saw chivalry and flags of truce in 1805. They humbugged us and we humbugged them. They plunder other people's houses, issue false paper money, and worst of all, they kill my children and my father, and then they talk of rules of war and magnanimity to foes. Take no prisoners, but kill and be killed. He who has come to this as I have through the same sufferings.
Prince Andrei, who had thought it was all the same to him whether or not Moscow was taken as Smolensk had been, was suddenly checked in his speech by an unexpected cramp in his throat. He paced up and down a few times in silence, but his eyes glittered feverishly and his lips quivered as he began speaking.
If there was none of this magnanimity in war, we should go to war only when it was worthwhile going to certain death, as now. Then there would not be war, because Paul Ivanovich had offended Mikhail Ivanovich, and when there was a war like this one, it would be war, and then the determination of the troops would be quite different. Then all those Westphalians and Hessians whom Napoleon is leading would not follow him into Russia, and we should not go to fight in Austria and Prussia without knowing why. War is not courtesy, but the most horrible thing in life, and we ought to understand that and not play at war. We ought to accept this terrible necessity sternly and seriously. It all lies in that. Get rid of falsehood, and let war be war and not a game. As it is now, war is the favourite pastime of the idle and frivolous. The military calling is the most highly honoured. But what is war? What is needed for success in warfare? What are the habits of the military? The aim of war is murder. The methods of war are spying, treachery, and their encouragement, the ruin of a country's inhabitants, robbing them or stealing to provision the army, and fraud and falsehood termed military craft. The habits of the military class are the absence of freedom, that is, discipline, idleness, ignorance, cruelty, debauchery, and drunkenness. And in spite of all this, it is the highest class, respected by everyone. All the kings, except the Chinese, wear military uniforms, and he who kills most people receives the highest rewards. They meet, as we shall meet tomorrow, to murder one another. They kill and maim tens of thousands, and then have thanksgiving services for having killed so many people. They even exaggerate the number. And they announce a victory, supposing that the more people they have killed, the greater their achievement. How does God above look at them and hear them? Exclaimed Prince Andrei in a shrill, piercing voice. Ah, my friend, it has of late become hard for me to live. I see that I have begun to understand too much, and it doesn't do for man to taste of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Ah, well, it's not for long, he added. However, you're sleepy, and it's time for me to sleep. Go back to Gorky, said Prince Andrei suddenly. Oh, no, Pierre replied, looking at Prince Andrei with frightened, compassionate eyes. Go, go! Before a battle one must have one's sleep, repeated Prince Andrei. He came quickly up to Pierre and embraced and kissed him. Goodbye, be off! He shouted. Whether we meet again or not! And turning away hurriedly, he entered the shed.
It was already dark, and Pierre could not make out whether the expression of Prince Andrei's face was angry or tender. For some time he stood in silence, considering whether he should follow him or go away. No, he does not want it, Pierre concluded. And I know that this is our last meeting. He sighed deeply and rode back to Gorky. On re-entering the shed, Prince Andrei lay down on a rug, but he could not sleep. He closed his eyes. One picture succeeded another in his imagination. On one of them he dwelt long and joyfully. He vividly recalled an evening in Petersburg. Natasha, with animated and excited face, was telling him how she had gone to look for mushrooms the previous summer and had lost her way in the big forest. She incoherently described the depths of the forest, her feelings, and a talk with a beekeeper she met, and constantly interrupted her story to say, "No, I can't. I'm not telling it right. No, you don't understand." Though he encouraged her by saying that he did understand, and he really had understood all she wanted to say. But Natasha was not satisfied with her own words. She felt that they did not convey the passionately poetic feeling she had experienced that day and wished to convey. "He was such a delightful old man, and it was so dark in the forest, and he had such kind—" No, I can't describe it," she had said, flushed and excited. Prince Andrei smiled now, the same happy smile as then, when he had looked into her eyes. "I understood her," he thought. "I not only understood her, but it was just that inner spiritual force, that sincerity, that frankness of soul, that very soul of hers which seemed to be fettered by her body. It was that soul I loved in her, loved so strongly and happily." And suddenly he remembered how his love had ended. He did not need anything of that kind. He neither saw nor understood anything of the sort. He only saw in her a pretty and fresh young girl with whom he did not deign to unite his fate. And I? And he is still alive and gay. Prince Andrei jumped up as if someone had burned him, and again began pacing up and down in front of the shed.
Chapter 26. Napoleon's Proclamation. On August the 25th, the eve of the Battle of Borodino, Monsieur de Beausset, prefect of the French Emperor's palace, arrived at Napoleon's quarters at Valuevo with Colonel Fabvier, the former from Paris and the latter from Madrid. Donning his court uniform, Monsieur de Beausset ordered a box he had brought for the Emperor to be carried before him, and entered the first compartment of Napoleon's tent, where he began opening the box while conversing with Napoleon's aides-de-camp, who surrounded him.
Fabvier, not entering the tent, remained at the entrance talking to some generals of his acquaintance. The Emperor Napoleon had not yet left his bedroom and was finishing his toilette. Slightly snorting and grunting, he presented now his back and now his plump, hairy chest to the brush with which his valet was rubbing him down. Another valet, with his finger over the mouth of a bottle, was sprinkling eau de cologne on the Emperor's pampered body, with an expression which seemed to say that he alone knew where and how much eau de cologne should be sprinkled. Napoleon's short hair was wet and matted on the forehead, but his face, though puffy and yellow, expressed physical satisfaction.
"Go on, harder, go on,"
he muttered to the valet who was rubbing him, slightly twitching and grunting. An aide-de-camp, who had entered the bedroom to report to the Emperor the number of prisoners taken in yesterday's action, was standing by the door after delivering his message, awaiting permission to withdraw. Napoleon, frowning, looked at him from under his brows.
"No prisoners," said he, repeating the aide-de-camp's words. "They are forcing us to exterminate them. So much the worse for the Russian army. Go on, harder, harder," he muttered, hunching his back and presenting his fat shoulders. "All right, let Monsieur de Beausset enter, and Fabvier, too," he said, nodding to the aide-de-camp.
"Yes, sir."
And the aide-de-camp disappeared through the door of the tent. Two valets rapidly dressed His Majesty, and wearing the blue uniform of the guards, he went with firm, quick steps to the reception room. De Beausset's hands, meanwhile, were busily engaged arranging the present he had brought from the Empress on two chairs directly in front of the entrance. But Napoleon had dressed and come out with such unexpected rapidity that he had not time to finish arranging the surprise. Napoleon noticed at once what they were about and guessed that they were not ready. He did not wish to deprive them of the pleasure of giving him a surprise, so he pretended not to see de Beausset and called Fabvier to him, listening silently and with a stern frown to what Fabvier told him of the heroism and devotion of his troops fighting at Salamanca at the other end of Europe, with but one thought, to be worthy of their emperor, and but one fear, to fail to please him. The result of that battle had been deplorable. Napoleon made ironic remarks during Fabvier's account, as if he had not expected that matters could go otherwise in his absence.
"I must make up for that in Moscow," said Napoleon. "I'll see you later," he added, and summoned de Beausset, who by that time had prepared the surprise, having placed something on the chairs and covered it with a cloth.
De Beausset bowed low, with that courtly French bow which only the old retainers of the Bourbons knew how to make, and approached him, presenting an envelope. Napoleon turned to him gaily and pulled his ear.
"You have hurried here. I'm very glad. Well, what is Paris saying?" he asked, suddenly changing his former stern expression for a most cordial tone.
"Sire, all Paris regrets your absence," replied de Beausset, as was proper.
But though Napoleon knew that de Beausset had to say something of this kind, and though in his lucid moments he knew it was untrue, he was pleased to hear it from him. Again he honoured him by touching his ear.
"I am very sorry to have made you travel so far," said he.
"Sire, I expected nothing less than to find you at the gates of Moscow," replied de Beausset.
Napoleon smiled, and lifting his head absent-mindedly, glanced to the right. An aide-de-camp approached with gliding steps and offered him a gold snuff-box, which he took.
"Yes, it has happened luckily for you," he said, raising the open snuff-box to his nose. "You are fond of travel, and in 3 days you will see Moscow. You surely did not expect to see that Asiatic capital. You will have a pleasant journey."
De Beausset bowed gratefully at this regard for his taste for travel, of which he had not till then been aware.
"Ha! What's this?" asked Napoleon, noticing that all the courtiers were looking at something concealed under a cloth.
With courtly adroitness, de Beausset half turned, and without turning his back to the Emperor, retired 2 steps, twitching off the cloth at the same time, and said,
"A present to your Majesty from the Empress."
It was a portrait, painted in bright colours by Gerard, of the son born to Napoleon by the daughter of the Emperor of Austria, the boy whom, for some reason, everyone called the King of Rome. A very pretty, curly-headed boy, with a look of the Christ in the Sistine Madonna, was depicted playing at stick and ball. The ball represented the terrestrial globe, and the stick in his other hand a sceptre. Though it was not clear what the artist meant to express by depicting the so-called King of Rome spiking the earth with a stick, the allegory apparently seemed to Napoleon, as it had done to all who had seen it in Paris, quite clear and very pleasing. "The King of Rome," he said, pointing to the portrait with a graceful gesture. "Admirable." With the natural capacity of an Italian for changing the expression of his face at will, he drew nearer to the portrait and assumed a look of pensive tenderness. He felt that what he now said and did would be historical, and it seemed to him that it would now be best for him, whose grandeur enabled his son to play stick and ball with the terrestrial globe, to show, in contrast to that grandeur, the simplest paternal tenderness. His eyes grew dim. He moved forward, glanced round at a chair which seemed to place itself under him, and sat down on it before the portrait. At a single gesture from him, everyone went out on tiptoe, leaving the great man to himself and his emotion. Having sat still for a while, he touched, himself not knowing why, the thick spot of paint representing the highest light in the portrait, rose, and recalled de Beausset and the officer on duty. He ordered the portrait to be carried outside his tent, that the old guard stationed round it might not be deprived of the pleasure of seeing the King of Rome, the son and heir of their adored monarch. And while he was doing Monsieur de Beausset the honour of breakfasting with him, they heard, as Napoleon had anticipated, the rapturous cries of the officers and men of the old guard who had run up to see the portrait.
"Vive l'Empereur! Vive le roi de Rome! Vive l'Empereur!"
came those ecstatic cries. After breakfast, Napoleon, in de Beausset's presence, dictated his order of the day to the army.
"Short and energetic," he remarked,
when he had read over the proclamation which he had dictated straight off without corrections. It ran,
"Soldiers, this is the battle you have so longed for. Victory depends on you. It is essential for us. It will give us all we need, comfortable quarters and a speedy return to our country. Behave as you did at Austerlitz, Friedland, Vitebsk, and Smolensk. Let our remotest posterity recall your achievements this day with pride. Let it be said of each of you, he was in the great battle before Moscow."
"Before Moscow," repeated Napoleon, and inviting Monsieur de Beausset, who was so fond of travel, to accompany him on his ride, he went out of the tent to where the horses stood saddled.
"Your Majesty is too kind," replied de Beausset to the invitation to accompany the Emperor. He wanted to sleep, did not know how to ride, and was afraid of doing so.
But Napoleon nodded to the traveller, and de Beausset had to mount. When Napoleon came out of the tent, the shouting of the guards before his son's portrait grew still louder. Napoleon frowned.
"Take him away," he said,
pointing with a gracefully majestic gesture to the portrait.
"It is too soon for him to see a field of battle."
De Beausset closed his eyes, bowed his head, and sighed deeply, to indicate how profoundly he valued and comprehended the Emperor's words. Chapter 27. Napoleon's Dispositions for the Battle of Borodino. On the 25th of August, so his historians tell us, Napoleon spent the whole day on horseback, inspecting the locality, considering plans submitted to him by his marshals, and personally giving commands to his generals. The original line of the Russian forces along the river Kolocha had been dislocated by the capture of the Shevardino redoubt on the 24th, and part of the line, the left flank, had been drawn back. That part of the line was not entrenched, and in front of it the ground was more open and level than elsewhere. It was evident to anyone, military or not, that it was here that the French should attack. It would seem that not much consideration was needed to reach this conclusion, nor any particular care or trouble on the part of the Emperor and his marshals. Nor was there any need of that special and supreme quality called genius that people are so apt to ascribe to Napoleon. Yet the historians who described the event later, and the men who then surrounded Napoleon and he himself, thought otherwise. Napoleon rode over the plain and surveyed the locality with a profound air and in silence, nodded with approval or shook his head dubiously, and without communicating to the generals around him the profound course of ideas which guided his decisions, merely gave them his final conclusions in the form of commands. Having listened to a suggestion from Davout, who was now called Prince d'Eckmühl, to turn the Russian left wing, Napoleon said it should not be done, without explaining why not. To a proposal made by General Campan, who was to attack the flesh, to lead his division through the woods, Napoleon agreed, though the so-called Duke of Elchingen, Ney, ventured to remark that a movement through the woods was dangerous and might disorder the division. Having inspected the country opposite the Shevardino Redoubt, Napoleon pondered a little in silence, and then indicated the spots where two batteries should be set up by the morrow to act against the Russian entrenchments, and the places where, in line with them, the field artillery should be placed. After giving these and other commands, he returned to his tent, and the dispositions for the battle were written down from his dictation. These dispositions, of which the French historians write with enthusiasm and other historians with profound respect, were as follows. At dawn, the two new batteries established during the night on the plain occupied by the Prince d'Eckmühl will open fire on the opposing batteries of the enemy. At the same time, the commander of the artillery of the First Corps, General Pernetti, with 30 cannon of Campan's division, and all the howitzers of Desaix's and Friant's divisions, will move forward, open fire, and overwhelm with shell-fire the enemy's battery, against which will operate 24 guns of the artillery of the Guards, 30 guns of Campan's division, and 8 guns of Friant's and Desaix's divisions, in all 62 guns. The commander of the artillery of the Third Corps, General Fouché, will place the howitzers of the Third and Eighth Corps, 16 in all, on the flanks of the battery, that is, to bombard the entrenchment on the left, which will have 40 guns in all directed against it. General Sorbier must be ready at the first order to advance with all the howitzers of the Guards' artillery against either one or other of the entrenchments. During the cannonade, Prince Poniatowski is to advance through the wood on the village and turn the enemy's position. General Campan will move through the wood to seize the first fortification. After the advance has begun in this manner, orders will be given in accordance with the enemy's movements. The cannonade on the left flank will begin as soon as the guns of the right wing are heard. The sharpshooters of Morand's division and of the division of the vice-king, General Murat, will open a heavy fire on seeing the attack commence on the right wing. The vice-king will occupy the village and cross by its three bridges, advancing to the same heights as Morand's and Gibrard's divisions, which, under his leadership, will be directed against the redoubt and come into line with the rest of the forces. All this must be done in good order. Le tout se fera avec ordre et méthode, as far as possible retaining troops in reserve. The Imperial Camp near Bozhesk, September the 6th, 1812. These dispositions, which are very obscure and confused if one allows oneself to regard the arrangements without religious awe of his genius, related to Napoleon's orders to deal with four points, four different orders. Not one of these was, or could be, carried out. In the disposition, it is said first that the batteries placed on the spot chosen by Napoleon, with the guns of Pernetti and Fouché, which were to come in line with them, 102 guns in all, were to open fire and shower shells on the Russian flesh and redoubts. This could not be done, as from the spot selected by Napoleon, the projectiles did not carry to the Russian works, and those 102 guns shot into the air until the nearest commander, contrary to Napoleon's instructions, moved them forward. The second order was that Poniatowski, moving to the village through the wood, should turn the Russian left flank. This could not be done, and was not done, because Poniatowski, advancing on the village through the wood, met Tushkov there, barring his way, and could not and did not turn the Russian position. The third order was, General Campin will move through the wood to seize the first fortification. General Campin's division did not seize the first fortification, but was driven back, for on emerging from the wood it had to reform under grapeshot, of which Napoleon was unaware. The fourth order was, the vice-king will occupy the village, Borodino, and cross by its three bridges, advancing to the same heights as Morand's and Gérard's divisions, for whose movements no directions are given, which, under his leadership, will be directed against the redoubt and come into line with the rest of the forces. As far as one can make out, not so much from this unintelligible sentence as from the attempts the vice-king made to execute the orders given him, he was to advance from the left through Borodino to the redoubt, while the divisions of Morand and Gérard were to advance simultaneously from the front. All this, like the other parts of the disposition, was not and could not be executed. After passing through Borodino, the vice-king was driven back to the Kolochar and could get no farther, while the divisions of Morand and Gérard did not take the redoubt but were driven back, and the redoubt was only taken at the end of the battle by the cavalry, a thing probably unforeseen and not heard of by Napoleon. So not one of the orders in the disposition was or could be executed. But in the disposition, it is said that after the fight has commenced in this manner, orders will be given in accordance with the enemy's movements, and so it might be supposed that all necessary arrangements would be made by Napoleon during the battle. But this was not, and could not, be done. For during the whole battle, Napoleon was so far away that, as appeared later, he could not know the course of the battle, and not one of his orders during the fight could be executed.
Chapter 28. Why the battle had to be fought. Many historians say that the French did not win the Battle of Borodino because Napoleon had a cold, and that if he had not had a cold, the orders he gave before and during the battle would have been still more full of genius, and Russia would have been lost and the face of the world have been changed. To historians who believe that Russia was shaped by the will of one man, Peter the Great, and that France from a republic became an empire and French armies went to Russia at the will of one man, Napoleon, to say that Russia remained a power because Napoleon had a bad cold on the 24th of August may seem logical and convincing. If it had depended on Napoleon's will to fight or not to fight the Battle of Borodino, and if this or that other arrangement depended on his will, then evidently a cold affecting the manifestation of his will might have saved Russia. And consequently, the valet who omitted to bring Napoleon his waterproof boots on the 24th would have been the saviour of Russia. Along that line of thought, such a deduction is indubitable, as indubitable as the deduction Voltaire made in jest, without knowing what he was jesting at, when he saw that the massacre of St. Bartholomew was due to Charles IX's stomach being deranged. But to men who do not admit that Russia was formed by the will of one man, Peter I, or that the French Empire was formed and the war with Russia begun by the will of one man, Napoleon, that argument seems not merely untrue and irrational, but contrary to all human reality. To the question of what causes historic events, another answer presents itself, namely, that the course of human events is predetermined from on high, depends on the coincidence of the wills of all who take part in the events, and that a Napoleon's influence on the course of these events is purely external and fictitious. Strange as at first glance it may seem to suppose that the massacre of St. Bartholomew was not due to Charles IX's will, though he gave the order for it and thought it was done as a result of that order, and strange as it may seem to suppose that the slaughter of 80,000 men at Borodino was not due to Napoleon's will, though he ordered the commencement and conduct of the battle and thought it was done because he ordered it, strange as these suppositions appear, yet human dignity, which tells me that each of us is, if not more, at least not less a man than the great Napoleon,
demands the acceptance of that solution of the question, and historic investigation abundantly confirms it. At the Battle of Borodino, Napoleon shot at no one and killed no one. That was all done by the soldiers. Therefore, it was not he who killed people. The French soldiers went to kill and be killed at the Battle of Borodino, not because of Napoleon's orders, but by their own volition. The whole army, French, Italian, German, Polish, and Dutch, hungry, ragged, and weary of the campaign, felt at the sight of an army blocking their road to Moscow that the wine was drawn and must be drunk. Had Napoleon then forbidden them to fight the Russians, they would have killed him and have proceeded to fight the Russians because it was inevitable. When they heard Napoleon's proclamation offering them, as compensation for mutilation and death, the words of posterity about their having been in the battle before Moscow, they cried, "Vive l'Empereur!" just as they had cried, "Vive l'Empereur!" at the sight of the portrait of the boy piercing the terrestrial globe with a toy stick, and just as they would have cried, "Vive l'Empereur!" at any nonsense that might be told them. There was nothing left for them to do but cry, "Vive l'Empereur!" and go to fight in order to get food and rest as conquerors in Moscow. So it was not because of Napoleon's commands that they killed their fellow men. And it was not Napoleon who directed the course of the battle, for none of his orders were executed, and during the battle he did not know what was going on before him. So the way in which these people killed one another was not decided by Napoleon's will, but occurred independently of him, in accordance with the will of hundreds of thousands of people who took part in the common action. It only seemed to Napoleon that it all took place by his will. And so the question whether he had or had not a cold has no more historic interest than the cold of the least of the transport soldiers. Moreover, the assertion made by various writers that his cold was the cause of his dispositions not being as well planned as on former occasions, and of his orders during the battle not being as good as previously, is quite baseless, which again shows that Napoleon's cold on the 26th of August was unimportant. The dispositions cited above are not at all worse, but are even better than previous dispositions by which he had won victories. His pseudo-orders during the battle were also no worse than formerly, but much the same as usual. These dispositions and orders only seem worse than previous ones because the Battle of Borodino was the first Napoleon did not win. The profoundest and most excellent dispositions and orders seem very bad, and every learned militarist criticizes them with looks of importance when they relate to a battle that has been lost, and the very worst dispositions and orders seem very good, and serious people fill whole volumes to demonstrate their merits when they relate to a battle that has been won. The dispositions drawn up by Weyrother for the Battle of Austerlitz were a model of perfection for that kind of composition. But still they were criticized. Criticized for their very perfection, for their excessive minuteness. Napoleon at the Battle of Borodino fulfilled his office as representative of authority as well as, and even better than, at other battles. He did nothing harmful to the progress of the battle. He inclined to the most reasonable opinions. He made no confusion, did not contradict himself, did not get frightened or run away from the field of battle, but with his great tact and military experience carried out his role of appearing to command calmly and with dignity. Chapter 29. The Game Begins. On returning from a second careful inspection of the lines, Napoleon remarked, "The chessmen are set up. The game will begin tomorrow." Having ordered punch and summoned de Bousset, he began to talk to him about Paris and about some changes he meant to make in the Empress's household, surprising the prefect by his memory of minute details relating to the court. He showed an interest in trifles, joked about de Bousset's love of travel, and chatted carelessly, as a famous, self-confident surgeon who knows his job does when turning up his sleeves and putting on his apron while a patient is being strapped to the operating table. "The matter is in my hands and is clear and definite in my head. When the time comes to set to work, I shall do it as no one else could. But now I can jest, and the more I jest and the calmer I am, the more tranquil and confident you ought to be, and the more amazed at my genius." Having finished his second glass of punch, Napoleon went to rest before the serious business which, he considered, awaited him next day. He was so much interested in that task that he was unable to sleep, and in spite of his cold, which had grown worse from the dampness of the evening, he went into the large division of the tent at 3 o'clock in the morning, loudly blowing his nose. He asked whether the Russians had not withdrawn, and was told that the enemy's fires were still in the same places. He nodded approval. The adjutant in attendance came into the tent.
"Well, Rapp, do you think we shall do good business today?" Napoleon asked him.
"Without doubt, sire," replied Rapp. Napoleon looked at him.
"Do you remember, sire, what you did me the honour to say at Smolensk?" continued Rapp. "The wine is drawn, and must be drunk."
Napoleon frowned and sat silent for a long time, leaning his head on his hand.
"This poor army," he suddenly remarked. "It has diminished greatly since Smolensk. Fortune is frankly a courtesan, Rapp. I've always said so, and I am beginning to experience it. But the guards, Rapp, the guards are intact?" he remarked interrogatively.
"Yes, sire," replied Rapp.
Napoleon took a lozenge, put it in his mouth, and glanced at his watch. He was not sleepy, and it was still not nearly morning. It was impossible to give further orders for the sake of killing time, for the orders had all been given and were now being executed.
"Have the biscuits and rice been served out to the regiments of the guards?" asked Napoleon sternly.
"Yes, sire."
"The rice, too."
Rapp replied that he had given the emperor's order about the rice, but Napoleon shook his head in dissatisfaction, as if not believing that his order had been executed. An attendant came in with punch. Napoleon ordered another glass to be brought for Rapp, and silently sipped his own.
"I have neither taste nor smell," he remarked, sniffing at his glass. "This cold is tiresome. They talk about medicine. What is the good of medicine when it can't cure a cold? Corvisart gave me these lozenges, but they don't help at all. What can doctors cure? One can't cure anything. Our body is a machine for living. It is organized for that. It is its nature. Let life go on in it unhindered, and let it defend itself. It will do more than if you paralyze it by encumbering it with remedies. Our body is like a perfect watch that should go for a certain time. Watchmaker cannot open it. He can only adjust it by fumbling, and that blindfold. Yes, our body is just a machine for living, that is all."
And having entered on the path of definition, of which he was fond, Napoleon suddenly and unexpectedly gave a new one.
"Do you know, Rapp, what military art is?"
asked he.
"It is the art of being stronger than the enemy at a given moment. That's all."
Rapp made no reply.
"Tomorrow we shall have to deal with Kutuzov," said Napoleon. "We shall see. Do you remember at Braunau he commanded an army for 3 weeks and did not once mount a horse to inspect his entrenchments? We shall see."
He looked at his watch. It was still only 4 o'clock. He did not feel sleepy. The punch was finished, and there was still nothing to do. He rose, walked to and fro, put on a warm overcoat and a hat, and went out of the tent. The night was dark and damp. A scarcely perceptible moisture was descending from above. Nearby, the campfires were dimly burning among the French guards, and in the distance, those of the Russian line shone through the smoke. The weather was calm, and the rustle and tramp of the French troops already beginning to move to take up their positions were clearly audible. Napoleon walked about in front of his tent, looked at the fires and listened to these sounds, and as he was passing a tall guardsman in a shaggy cap, who was standing sentinel before his tent and had drawn himself up like a black pillar at sight of the emperor, Napoleon stopped in front of him.
"What year did you enter the service?"
he asked, with that affectation of military bluntness and geniality with which he always addressed the soldiers. The man answered the question.
"Ah, one of the old ones. Has your regiment had its rice?"
"It has, Your Majesty."
Napoleon nodded and walked away. At 5:30, Napoleon rode to the village of Shevardino. It was growing light. The sky was clearing. Only a single cloud lay in the east. The abandoned campfires were burning themselves out in the faint morning light. On the right, a single deep report of a cannon resounded and died away in the prevailing silence. Some minutes passed. A second and a third report shook the air, then a fourth and a fifth boomed solemnly nearby on the right. The first shots had not yet ceased to reverberate before others rang out, and yet more were heard mingling with and overtaking one another. Napoleon with his suite rode up to the Shevardino redoubt, where he dismounted. The game had begun. Chapter 30. Pierre views the battlefield from the knoll at Gorki. On returning to Gorki, after having seen Prince Andrei, Pierre ordered his groom to get the horses ready and to call him early in the morning, and then immediately fell asleep behind a partition in a corner Boris had given up to him. Before he was thoroughly awake next morning, everybody had already left the hut. The panes were rattling in the little windows, and his groom was shaking him. "Your Excellency! Your Excellency! Your Excellency!" he kept repeating pertinaciously, while he shook Pierre by the shoulder without looking at him, having apparently lost hope of getting him to wake up. "What? Has it begun? Is it time?" Pierre asked, waking up. "Hear the firing," said the groom, a discharged soldier. "All the gentlemen have gone out, and His Serene Highness himself rode past long ago." Pierre dressed hastily and ran out to the porch. Outside, all was bright, fresh, dewy, and cheerful. The sun, just bursting forth from behind a cloud that had concealed it, was shining, with rays still half broken by the clouds, over the roofs of the street opposite, on the dew-besprinkled dust of the road, on the walls of the houses, on the windows, the fence, and on Pierre's horses standing before the hut. The roar of guns sounded more distinct outside. An adjutant, accompanied by a Cossack, passed by at a sharp trot. "It's time, Count! It's time!" cried the adjutant. Telling the groom to follow him with the horses, Pierre went down the street to the knoll from which he had looked at the field of battle the day before. A crowd of military men was assembled there. Members of the staff could be heard conversing in French, and Kutuzov's grey head in a white cap with a red band was visible, his grey nape sunk between his shoulders. He was looking through a field glass down the high road before him. Mounting the steps to the knoll, Pierre looked at the scene before him, spellbound by beauty. It was the same panorama he had admired from that spot the day before, but now the whole place was full of troops and covered by smoke clouds from the guns, and the slanting rays of the bright sun, rising slightly to the left behind Pierre, cast upon it through the clear morning air penetrating streaks of rosy, golden-tinted light and long dark shadows. The forest at the farthest extremity of the panorama seemed carved in some precious stone of a yellowish-green colour. Its undulating outline was silhouetted against the horizon and was pierced beyond Valuevo by the Smolensk High Road, crowded with troops. Nearer at hand glittered golden cornfields interspersed with copses. There were troops to be seen everywhere, in front and to the right and left. All this was vivid, majestic, and unexpected. But what impressed Pierre most of all was the view of the battlefield itself, of Borodino, and the hollows on both sides of the Kolochar. Above the Kolochar, in Borodino and on both sides of it, especially to the left, where the Vojna flowing between its marshy banks falls into the Kolochar, a mist had spread which seemed to melt, to dissolve, and to become translucent when the brilliant sun appeared and magically coloured and outlined everything. The smoke of the guns mingled with this mist, and over the whole expanse and through that mist the rays of the morning sun were reflected, flashing back like lightning from the water, from the dew, and from the bayonets of the troops crowded together by the river banks and in Borodino. A white church could be seen through the mist, and here and there the roofs of huts in Borodino, as well as dense masses of soldiers or green ammunition chests and ordnance. And all this moved, or seemed to move, as the smoke and mist spread out over the whole space. Just as in the mist-enveloped hollow near Borodino, so along the entire line outside and above it, and especially in the woods and fields to the left, in the valleys and on the summits of the high ground, clouds of powder smoke seemed continually to spring up out of nothing, now singly, now several at a time, some translucent, others dense, which swelling, growing, rolling, and blending extended over the whole expanse. These puffs of smoke, and, strange to say, the sound of the firing, produced the chief beauty of the spectacle. Puff! Suddenly a round, compact cloud of smoke was seen merging from violet into grey and milky white, and boom! Came the report a second later. Puff! Puff! And two clouds arose, pushing one another and blending together, and boom! Boom! Came the sounds confirming what the eye had seen. Pierre glanced round at the first cloud, which he had seen as a round, compact ball, and in its place already were balloons of smoke floating to one side, and puff, with a pause, puff, puff, three and then four more appeared, and then from each, with the same interval, boom, 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 came the fine, firm, precise sounds in reply. It seemed as if those smoke clouds sometimes ran and sometimes stood still, while woods, fields, and glittering bayonets ran past them. From the left, over fields and bushes, these large balls of smoke were continually appearing, followed by their solemn reports, while nearer still, in the hollows and woods, there burst from the muskets small cloudlets that had no time to become balls, but had their little echoes in just the same way. Trac-tac-a-tac! Came the frequent crackle of musketry, but it was irregular and feeble in comparison with the reports of the cannon. Pierre wished to be there with that smoke, those shining bayonets, that movement, and those sounds. He turned to look at Kutuzov and his suite, to compare his impressions with those of the others. They were all looking at the field of battle as he was, and, as it seemed to him, with the same feelings. All their faces were now shining with that latent warmth of feeling Pierre had noticed the day before and had fully understood after his talk with Prince Andrei.
"Go, my dear fellow, go, and Christ be with you," Kutuzov was saying to a general who stood beside him, not taking his eye from the battlefield. Having received this order, the general passed by Pierre on his way down the knoll.
"To the crossing!"
said the general coldly and sternly, in reply to one of the staff who asked where he was going.
"I'll go there too, I too," thought Pierre, and followed the general.
The general mounted a horse a Cossack had brought him. Pierre went to his groom, who was holding his horses, and asking which was the quietest, clambered onto it, seized it by the mane, and turning out his toes, pressed his heels against its sides, and feeling that his spectacles were slipping off but unable to let go of the mane and reins, he galloped after the general, causing the staff officers to smile as they watched him from the knoll.
Chapter 31 Pierre Under Fire. Having descended the hill, the general after whom Pierre was galloping turned sharply to the left, and Pierre, losing sight of him, galloped in among some ranks of infantry marching ahead of him. He tried to pass either in front of them or to the right or left, but there were soldiers everywhere, and all with the same preoccupied expression and busy with some unseen but evidently important task. They all gazed with the same dissatisfied and inquiring expression at this stout man in a white hat, who for some unknown reason threatened to trample them under his horse's hoofs.
"Why ride into the middle of the battalion?"
one of them shouted at him. Another prodded his horse with the butt end of his musket, and Pierre, bending over his saddle-bow and hardly able to control his shying horse, galloped ahead of the soldiers where there was a free space. There was a bridge ahead of him where other soldiers stood firing. Pierre rode up to them. Without being aware of it, he had come to the bridge across the Kolochar between Gorky and Borodino, which the French, having occupied Borodino, were attacking in the first phase of the battle. Pierre saw that there was a bridge in front of him, and that soldiers were doing something on both sides of it, and in the meadow among the rows of new-mown hay which he had taken no notice of amid the smoke of the camp fires the day before. But despite the incessant firing going on there, he had no idea that this was the field of battle. He did not notice the sound of the bullets whistling from every side, or the projectiles that flew over him, did not see the enemy on the other side of the river, and for a long time did not notice the killed.